A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This is the William Hill Sports Book Club. We're looking at books in the running for Sports Book of the Year, and this week we are focusing on a book that's intrigued me for a while and intrigued me even more since I read it, Pete Carville's Death of a Boxer.
So the emotional part of it was you wanted to write in a way that you have to be honest about what happened, but I didn't want it to look like it was kicking him while he was down.
It's tragic but uplifting. It's brutal but gentle. It's another literary sporting masterpiece, and it's like no sports book I think I've ever read. We've got a full studio to talk about it, so let's get on with the William Hill Sports Book Club on TalkSport 2. Neil Foggin is with us as ever, known as Foggy, who reads the books, basically, for William Hill. All right, Neil?
Hello, you all right?
I'll call you Foggy from now on, OK?
That's all right.
As should everybody else. The champ, TalkSport's boxing god, Spencer Oliver. You OK?
Yeah, very well, thanks.
A privilege to have you with us. Thank you very much. And the author of the book we're focusing on for this episode, Pete Carville. First and foremost, Pete, congratulations on a brilliant book. How proud are you of this work?
Thanks for having me and for the very, very kind words. I'm actually really, really proud of it. It's my first book, and I'm going to hit 43 in September, and all my life I wanted to write books. And the fact that I managed to get one out after so many years is, it's at the moment it's a dream come true. And sat here as well in the studio with these lovely people as well, including the great Spencer Oliver, is also in itself a dream come true.
It is for me too. He's the champ. A couple of months ago, Foggy mentioned this book to me, and I actually said, Death of a Boxer. He actually said, Death of a Boxer, wonder what that's about. And I thought to myself, this is a snakes on a plane moment. We know what it's about. It's the title. It's about the death of a boxer. However, I read it, and I was so wrong. It is actually about the death of a boxer, which we'll get into, Mike Towle from Dundee in 2016 after a fight in Glasgow. It's also about the deaths of other boxers as well. It's about boxing. It's about masculinity. It's about boys growing up to be men, why men fight. It's about the state of boxing right now as well. It's about a lot of things, and there are fantastic descriptions in the book. It's beautifully written in places about fights and fighters. There are informative interviews, loads of interviews. You've been all over the place gathering knowledge for this book, Pete. I've been desperate to ask you this since I finished reading it. When someone asks you to describe what sort of book it is, what's your answer? How do you describe it?
I always say it's a book of love stories. I wanted to go out and I wanted to write about fighters and fights, but I didn't want it just be negative, because we have a lot of negativity in the world right now. And I wanted to go at it essentially with the best of intentions. I wanted to go out and say, look, this is it's a brutal thing, right? It is brutal. You watch two guys hit each other, it's brutal. But I wanted to sort of find the beauty in it as well, and the grace. And I really, really wanted to do the best by the people in it. Because when you go to talk to people, and I've done sensitive interviews for this book where people have not wanted to talk, or they've been really wary about talking about difficult things. And the one thing they always say to me is, please don't embarrass me. And that's what I think. If you go into it with the point of view that you want to embarrass somebody, or you want to just dig up the dirt, or you want to, you know, do something negative, that's not a good way to do it. So that's why I say, when people say to me, what type of book it is, I say it's a book of love stories.
When you actually say that in the book, you describe it as a sequence and series of love stories. And then the introduction bit is about Mike Towle and the fight and the death, and that's a running theme throughout the book. And I'm thinking to myself, how is this a love story when a boxer unfortunately dies as part of the main story throughout the book? And the way you handle that, I think, is incredibly skillful writing. But I think those reading it, I'm left at the beginning of the book thinking, how is this going to be a love story? So I think you've done that really, really well. That must have been quite tricky to write, bearing in mind how stark and dark that story about Mike Towle is.
Yeah, it's definitely... The Towle stuff, in a way, was kind of the easiest to write because there was a fairly extensive inquiry following his passing, and there was a 160-page report that came out. So a lot of that stuff is based on the report. Obviously, I've gone back and interviewed people as well. Where it was difficult is that you end up with all these sort of disparate parts of the book. So you end up, I was in Poland for the Usyk Dubois fight, and I was in Runcorn, the Runcorn ABC. And in doing this, you think, okay, you have it. How's it all going to come together? And then eventually the story was, I spoke to the publishers and I said, look, I just want to write about Mike Towle. And the publisher said, look, it's a good story, but it's not enough for a book. Like, it has to be longer. So they said, well, you have all these interesting stories from 20-something years in boxing. And I said, I do. And so, well, put that into the book, make it a little bit more personal. And I said, okay. And so I sat down to try and figure out where it was going to go. And I thought, well, I have all these bits and pieces, and I wanted to make it into the life cycle of boxing, from the young amateurs to the older professionals who are looking back on where they've come from.
Mm, yeah, I personally think that it's a genius move, if I'm honest, because like you say, when you read the title of Death of the Boxer, you don't know where that is going to go. And you just think, listen, love story, you can't connect the love story with that. I can connect that because I understand the love story with a guy that becomes a boxer and can't get divorced from that sport, and sometimes leave it too long, go on too long, and we do get these tragic stories or very sad stories in boxing as well, where the guy struggles because of that love relationship with the sport. They struggle to get divorced from it and they can't let go, and it goes on too long. So totally, totally understand it. I mean, I thought it was a fantastic read as well. I thought it was very powerful for me personally at the beginning with Mike Towle because of my experiences in the boxing ring and going through that as well. When you're reading it, you're sort of reliving it. It's worded so well that it sort of took me back to the times when I'd been through a similar experience with Mike. Thankfully, you know, I made a full recovery. But yeah, it was. I thought it was very, very well written, and brilliant, brilliant read.
Okay, thank you again for the kind words, Spencer. Yeah, when I was writing the Mike Towle sections, particularly the very first part of the book, I wanted it to be very immediate and very, like, as if you were there watching it. And I didn't want to ever slow the pace down by saying, okay, well, at this point, this means blah, blah, blah. You'd literally just seen fact after fact after fact after fact, which brings it all the way up to that tragic ending. And then after that first chapter, I wanted to slow the pace down, which is why it then moves all the way to Pennsylvania, and you have the story of the guy running with his dad. And I wanted to explore as well what it's like, well, what it is to be a man. You know, we're still figuring this out after a century, right? And I wanted to write, because obviously we know boxing hurts people and people get hurt, but we also know, like, the amount of young boys it takes off the street and shows them a better way, and it shows them how to not just fight, and I'm sure, Spencer, you'll know this, but how to actually be gentle and kind and well-mannered and polite and respectful. And I think you have to balance it. You can't say it's entirely a bad thing to box, and you can't entirely say it's a good thing to box. It's the question is, where do you find that balance?
I think to answer that, I think that, you know, being an ex-fighter myself, I think that for every life that boxing takes, it saves millions, you know, in the defence of the sport, you know, where it transforms the lives of these juvenile delinquents that are going down the wrong road and whatever, and they get put into the boxing ring, and it teaches them the life skills that they need and can teach them the discipline that they need to get on, and the focus as well to get on in life, and it puts them in that direction. Whether they become a boxer or not, it sort of teaches them the life skills, and I think that is so important. But, you know, unfortunately, when you do get these tragic circumstances as well, that always raises, you know, questions about the sport and how barbaric it can be at sometimes. And, you know, it's the beautiful brutality of boxing, isn't it, really? You know, in some ways, you know, it's one of those sports that is so brutal, you know, and we see these fights week in, week out, and you sort of think, sometimes me as an ex-fighter as well, I sit there watching some of these fights, and you watch it as these fights unfolding, and you think, these guys are going to a place that no normal human being would go to. Like, the depths of where they're going is absolutely insane. And you watch it, and sometimes I watch it and think, how did I do that? How did I go there? But something is drawing me to watch it. Do you know what I mean? And that is that beautiful brutality of what I'm talking about, where you know, we're watching something unfold, and it is very brutal, but you can't take your eyes off it. And I think that's the sport, isn't it?
That's where I'm in awe of all boxers. And when I used to do the drive show here on TalkSport, one of the early rules I made was, even though I wasn't specifically madly into boxing, one of the things I always said was, respect to any boxer, whatever level, gets in the ring and is prepared to have their head punched in by another boxer. You've just got to admire the bravery of that, because they know where it could lead.
Yeah.
But they have that love for doing it, so you've got to respect that. So I never, if there was a boxer who got absolutely hammered, fight him, fight out, never called them out, never once. It was always full of admiration for them.
Do you know the insanity surrounding boxing is the ultimate gladiatorial sport? You know, it is one of those where, you know, you're willing to get up there and put effectively your life on the line for the pleasure of others, but you get in there, but there's something like, you know, something that you actually sort of like love about it. But after you've had that event, you know, with this guy where you've built up so much hatred to try and get yourself in the position, the mindset that you need going in there before the first bell rings, you think, this guy's trying to take my living away, you know, my financial security for my family. That's like, so you're drumming all this up, you go there, but because of what you go through, you two, and what you two share, and it's only a moment that you two share, that the love that you get for this guy after the fight, when that final bell rings, win or lose, you've shared that moment yourselves, just you two, and that will never ever change. And you both been through there, and because it is that ultimate gladiatorial thing, you get a respect for this guy like a family member in many ways. It's crazy trying to explain it. Does that make sense?
You've got to be in it really to fully understand.
You've got to be in it
to totally
understand it. If you've never been in it, you'd never understand it.
Like, it's just, you can never go. But
No,
Foggy, I want to bring you in here because Pete just touched on something about some of the stuff where he said, there's quotes in the book, a boy needs a good man to show him how to be good. Toxic masculinity is the wrong way to define or diagnose the problem. This is deep, profound writing. Some of the stuff that judges look at when you're looking at these sports books.
Yeah, and for me, for this, it's an emotional roller coaster. And we've had a few boxing books in the past, and you can't judge it based on other books. You've got to look at it, this book on its own, and go, is this good enough? And for me, I thought it's a great book. As I always say, you want to give it to somebody who doesn't like sport, doesn't like boxing, say, read this, it's going to change your perception. And this book will do that. And the beauty of this book as well is that you've got an appendix at the back which explains it. So even if you don't particularly know your boxing, you can go to the back first, read that, and then you're going to enjoy the book. The words that Peter uses in it, he describes stuff. It all comes to life in your memory. And I think the thing which, I'm not a huge boxing fan, but what I do for a living, and so the interviews we do recently on with Simon Jordan with boxers, I've got a great understanding now and a respect for boxing. But I think we get caught up in the world we live in on the glamorous of the heavyweights and Sky Box Office and the TNT and DAZN. This takes you back to the roots of boxing. And we're looking at it from kids who are trying to stay out of trouble, their parents are trying to keep them out of trouble in Runcorn, to guys who are having to pay and are out of pocket because they have a love and passion of boxing for their paying. So it shows all angles. And I think that's what makes this book a really good book.
Yeah, there's a quote in there, Pete. I just want to bring it to you. It's you're talking about a fighter. It's when you go over to, is it Yigit?
I think Yigit, yeah.
Yeah. And you say, Yigit began to throw from a place beyond caution. He gave all of himself. Most men were reminded of their cowardice and had to look away. Mm. And you can imagine, you know, the kind of punches that are being thrown, that people did have to look away from something they found really hard to take.
Yeah, I was there in Poland for that fight, and in that sort of 11th, 12th round with Anthony and Boris Derenchik, I think his name was, it was brutal. Like, you couldn't look away. You couldn't look away. But at the same time, and Spencer, I'm sure you noticed, when you see these punches come in, you think every single time one lands, you're like, I'm glad that's not me. Because you know on a primal level, there's damage being done here that's never going to get fixed. And you have to look away, because I couldn't do it.
One more quote I want to give you before we break, first of all, is it's going back to the thing about boys becoming men, and I think it's a really deep part of the book. It had me hooked quite early on in the book. One of your quotes here is, it's about you. It says, I wanted most of all to be a man. The path to manhood involved pain and the ability to inflict it. I fell in love with that world. Now, I'm a lover, not a fighter. Okay, there's no way in a million years I want to inflict or receive pain. So I can't compute that. I can't understand that. So can you expand on that?
Sure. So when I was 19 and I was writing a book, I was very tall, very skinny. I probably weighed about 155 now, which is probably 90 pounds less than I am now. And I was a nerd, right? I was a Star Wars nerd all the way through my teenage years. And I left home at 19. I moved away, went to live in York and later in Sheffield. And I went to work in bars and nightclubs. And the guys that were kind of like, not mentors, but the guys, like the older guys, the ones I was looking up to show me how to be a man at that time, were like doormen and like tough guys. And I felt threatened at times in that world because I was so skinny and such a gangly, overgrown, nerdy kid that I thought, well, I need to man up, as it were. And for me, there was a boxing club I went past all the time, and I thought, I'll just go give that a go. And that's what I went into it. But then as soon as I started it, like, you know, I put some, you know, I put about, you know, 15, 20 pounds of muscle on within a couple of months, and then people started not respecting me, but they started looking at me in a different way, and I felt more like a man as well. And now I get a little bit older now, and I think maybe it's not the only way to be a man, you know. Maybe there is something to be said for being kind and being gentle. Incidentally, qualities that I did learn more about when I was boxing, but I realized at 42 and I have kids of my own now, is that I don't need to be a tough guy to be a man.
I think what it is that boxing gains that respect, instant respect. As soon as somebody says, yeah, this guy's a boxer, he does boxing, whatever, you gain the respect from the general public, basically. And that's basically what it is. And I think from you travelling down that road and just looking, saying you want to go from a boy to a man, you go, right, this is the ultimate gladiatorial thing. What is it that I can gain respect from other people from? I go in there and I go into a boxing gym, I'm going to instantly gain respect. And I think that's what it is, you know, and I truly do believe that. And I think that, you know, for over the many years that I've seen, my dad used to run Finchley ABC. We saw so many kids come in, not because they wanted to be boxers, because they were lacking in confidence or whatever. And they come in with their heads down, chest in, and they walk in. And after being in there for 3 or 4 months and learning the skills and, you know, the art of boxing, you see them and you start, and it changes their personality, changes their persona. You see the chest come up. They feel they're full of confidence. But ultimately, they understand what it is, so they don't become them bullies or anything because they've got that, even though they've been bullied. Yeah. But it just gives them the respect to respect others. And I think that is the importance of boxing, you know, that it's not just about, you know, it's not just about the competing, the fighting. I think it's about what it teaches, what it teaches people and how it changes lives.
Yeah, I honestly think that stuff like boxing, and particularly boxing, because this is the prism through which I look at everything now, is that it's ultimately beneficial for boys to do it. Because boys and girls are very different, right? We know this, right? And girls and boys respond to being raised in different ways. I think boys genuinely respond well to boxing, right? So if you take a boy off the street, he's disrespectful, he doesn't know how to carry himself. You train him up and you show him not only how to respect himself, but how to respect others. And that's really how you achieve anything in life, is being able to sit down and being able to talk and respect other people. Because if you don't have respect for other people, you'll never learn how to respect yourself.
Can I give you the quote then?
Go on.
Junior Brain Bank chapter, which is it's dark, it's deep. I recommend anybody, if they don't want to read the book, read the chapter on the brain bank. It's incredible. It's about a brain bank in Boston where they examine and study the brain. And Dr. Anne McKee at the Brain Bank says she hates American football, hates boxing, says it's gruesome, really hates children's boxing. She says it's very misguided. Children are set up for brain trauma, she said. It's a very irresponsible decision by a parent to allow their kid into the ring. Pete, I'll come to you in a second, but Spencer, what do you make of that? Bearing in mind your dad ran Finchley ABC.
Absolutely. Listen, I started when I was a 7-year-old kid. You know, that was pretty much where the journey began for me, as it did for many other people that went on to become champions and whatnot. Listen, I totally understand what she's saying. I totally get that. But like I say, for the injuries that we get within the sport and for the lives that it takes within the sport and the lives that it changes and whatnot, you've got to weigh it up and you just go, like, it's all about opportunity and hope for some people that come from certain areas. You're talking about Runcorn and the kids that are coming from up there. And, you know, you look at these estates that effectively where these kids come from, because boxing has a background of, you know, getting kids in from deprived areas and whatnot and getting there, and it gives them a little bit of hope and opportunity and the chance to try and achieve something in their lives. And if you look at that and you listen to some of the stories, the backstories from a lot of these champions, Anthony Joshua, let's use him as an example. Anthony Joshua walked into my dad's gym, finished the ABC at 18 years of age. This kid was in so much trouble. He was smoking weed, he was drinking, he was living a terrible life. He had an ASBO against him in Watford. His cousin Ben Ali, he brought him in the gym. Ben was boxing for the club at the time, said, listen, Josh, come down the gym. He likes running and he likes basketball and whatnot. He said, come down the gym. We're like, we could just take you down there because you can't go out anywhere. You can't do anything. Like, you know, you've got yourself in that sort of situation. His life was spiraling out of control. Josh would come in the gym. He saw it as something that he liked, and actually he was quite good at it. You look, 2 years later, he become ABA champion. 4 years later, he become a world amateur silver medalist. Then he won the Olympics. Then he turned professional. 8 years after the first day he walked in the gym, he'd become world champion. And he changed his life. And what he'd done on that journey was he inspired millions of other kids that come from that sort of background to say, listen, you know, put your knives down, put your guns down, stop taking drugs, stop drinking. This is what you can achieve. I've done it and I've come from that background, and it's just showing you. And that gives kids hope and opportunity. And I think that is the great story, and that is the great success story of boxing. Anthony Joshua is a prime example to use for that. So I understand what the lady's saying, and I totally appreciate that. But, you know, it's not just all doom and gloom. I think there is hope and opportunity on the flip side of that argument as well.
Can I just say, Anne McKee is probably one of the nicest people I've ever met as well. Yeah. And she really is. Although I would recommend, if you go to visit the Brain Bank in Boston, where they have all these half brains out, like, don't go just after breakfast, which is what I did, because it's not. You're trying to sort of brave it out by being like, yeah, I'm fine with this. And part of you is going, oh,
yeah, sure.
Good tip. Yeah, one of the things that's in the book, and it's in the early Runcorn chapters as well, and it was one of those beautiful coincidences that you couldn't plan for, is that there are two sets of brothers in the book. So there's Dean and his brother, who I've called Stephen in the book. He's actually got a different name, but because the sensitivities there, I changed his name for the book. So there's Dean and Stephen, and then there's Daz, who runs Runcorn ABC, and his brother. And Daz and Dean are both doing quite well in life now. They've kind of, you know, found a way through sports, and, you know, Daz is running his Runcorn ABC, and Dean has just qualified as an actor. And by the way, Dean's a really good actor as well. So if anyone's listening and wants to cast someone for something, like, cast Dean, right? So Daz and Dean have done quite well in life overall, but their brothers went down a different path, and their brothers didn't have combat sports. So Daz's brother was in prison for 20 years, and Stephen has had a lot of difficulties, and I'm not going to go into one here, but it's with Daz and Dean, it was the fighting that saved them, ironically, you know. And even though both of them didn't do anything, we're not, I'm going to apologise in advance, Daz and Dean, even though they didn't have great in-ring or in-cage careers, they've still managed to use it as a way to not go down these same dark paths that their siblings did.
And Foggy, I think that's part of it. The fact that Anne McKee's analysis and all that evidence is included in the book shows there's balance there in the argument.
Yeah, and I know from my personal experience, I've got two nephews, and one of them is very small, and a lot smaller than everyone else in the class. So my sister found a local boxing trainer, and he's trained with him for a few years, and now he's got confidence. That's the main thing he's got. He can handle himself if bullies come up to him, which they don't expect because he's a small kid. But he's got the thing. And then my other nephew, he's continued with the boxing. He does it really just for confidence, discipline, and to keep fit. That's all he wants to do. So I think it's important that people do it for different reasons. And this is what the beauty of this book is. It's balanced. We've got everyone's argument. We've got the stuff when we're talking about Mike Town and him going to the hospital and telling the doctors one thing and not acting. But then you've got his mum's view of why you're saying that, and you need to go to these appointments. So it's balanced. It's not just one-sided.
It's a very good point, and we'll talk more about Mike Town in a second. This is the William Hill Sports Book Club. This is TalkSport 2.
Well, it is going to continue, but you wonder for how much longer it's over.
Dale Evans, again, he is applauding Mikey Towle as he's taken out of the ring.
The running theme through the book is the death of Mike Towle, who fought Dale Evans in Glasgow in 2016. The details harrowing, his health issues before the fights, the fact that somehow he still went into the ring, and then the aftermath. Pete Carville, how hard was that to research for your book, Death of a Boxer?
Actually, it was one of the more straightforward things to research. After Mike Towle's passing, there was an inquest. It's called a fatal accident inquiry in Scotland, and there was a 165-ish page report that came out. So a lot of the Mike Towle stuff is based on that report. And obviously, I did go to Dundee, and I interviewed people that knew him. I was in Cardiff. I talked to Gary Lockett, who was in the opposite corner. I interviewed him as well. And then you have all the videos that exist, and then you have all the newspapers that came out. So that was actually one of the more straightforward parts to write. The difficulty with it, I mean, that's from a technical point of view. The difficulty that came with it is you want to write it in a way, and I spoke to members of Towle's family afterwards, after the book came out, who read it, and by the way, they really, really like it. Even though they're not quoted directly in the book, they actually really, really like the book. I've kind of my train of thought now. So the emotional part of it was you wanted to write it in a way that you have to be honest about what happened, but I didn't want it to look like it was kicking him while he was down, right? And so that's why it's very much... I tried to take all the colour out of that writing, you know. So if I'd started writing, you know, oh, he did this and he did that, it was a terrible idea, blah, 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 that's passing a judgment on him, which is I didn't want to do. I wanted to just let the facts speak for themselves.
Yeah, it was an interesting one because, like I say, when I was reading that, that was the hard part of the book for me personally to read because of my own experiences going through that, like, you know, when you read, like, Mike had to take 3 pounds off in an hour before that contest. And I go, listen, I know when you're tight at the weight, because that was what effectively caused my damage as well. When you're tight at the weight, I go, losing 3 pounds is like the normal guy losing 3 stones. It's literally that much. And it's all fluid you're taking away. You got your brain's in a, you know, a cushion of fluid, and you've got thousands of blood vessels in and around the brain, and they lose that elasticity because it becomes dry. The cushioning goes, so the brain can knock against the skull, and the blood vessels in and around the brain, they lose the elasticity. They become like bits of straw. And so, you know, one little punch and one of the vessels can snap, like it did with me. And I had a heavy nosebleed. I don't really have any bones in my nose, so I never used to suffer with nosebleeds or anything like that. And I had a heavy nosebleed, which was coming from the bleed in the brain. And as a fight wears on or whatever, the blood clots. And, you know, and that's sort of pretty much how it happened. So I understood that Mike was struggling badly to make the weight. And there was a lot of, you know, we're always going to hear this after the contest. And once, you know, certain circumstances have happened, people then raise alarm bells. Should he have done this? Should he have done that? And, you know, should he have been allowed to box? But, you know, he passed the medical exams. Yes, he was tight at the weight. And that effectively would have been the reasons for him, you know, getting damaged, really. Yeah. I think that's where the problems really underlie. It was interesting because when that happened as well, I sort of got close with myself and my wife, got close with Mike's wife at the time, because obviously what she was going through, and I was trying to sort of, like, you know, support her the best that I could because I'd been through something very similar, and we raised some money. Boxing with the Stars that I'd done with Jake Wood, we raised some money for her and her young son as well, just as... to show a little bit of support, really, because of what she'd been to. But it was tragic circumstances, it really was.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's obvious, looking back from in the report, it's in the book, that there were issues in the years going into the fight, and he was tight at the weight. But for me, the question was all, for me, about the book, and the one that forms the book as well, is that if Mike Towle had stopped fighting, if he'd said, look, I've got these issues going on, you know, with the seizures and the migraines, The common sense thing would be to stop, right? But he didn't. And that was the question I wanted to ask. Why? What was it about boxing that he was so identified himself with that he could not stop?
I could answer that question. Go on. I can answer that question for you, because I think that, like you say, there was underlining problems there that Mike wanted to keep to himself because he had a young family and he was striving to achieve the heights because he recognised that he had that ability and that he had that opportunity. Probably, like, life without boxing for Mike was not particularly good life at all, if I'm honest, you know, because he never had that education. You know, he come from that background where you speak to his friends that were in and around that at the time. You go, look, boxing was his saviour. Like, without boxing, this kid would have been going down the wrong path. I think that's what it was. And I think for Mike, like, when he's having, you know, these problems in the build-up to the fight that we later found out after the fight, and you just recognise and you go, why wouldn't you stop? You'd like, that is insane, the insanity around that. You go, but for Mike himself, he's thinking, no, I'll be fine. Mm. I'll be fine, but this is my only opportunity. And I think that's where it is, that Mike's looking at it and he's going, no, I'm going to be all right. I'm going to be all right. You know, this will go away. But I've got that ability to be able to go on and I'll become a champion and I'll secure the financial security for my young kid and my family. And that's what it is. Once that young child's born into your life, you're looking at it and you're going, now it's a different game now. It's not about me. It's about the kid. And I'm going to go to, look, the insanity of a boxer anyway, like we talked about earlier on in the show, we go, you know, when you're getting into those brutal fights and you think, how are these two human beings going to this dark place where they're going to? They're doing it for a reason. And for Mike, it was a young child and you know, his wife, he was a 25-year-old kid that was trying to change the futures and their lives. And you've got to respect that. You go, like, this guy, and that's why he never said anything, because he goes, what would I do without that? Without boxing, take boxing out of my life, and where does it end?
Yeah, one of the guys that's in the book, and he's in the book a little bit as well, is Erik Skoglund from Sweden, I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
And I actually did a much longer piece on Erik about 4 years ago, and Erik had his own injury while sparring and spent, I think, 10, 11 days in a coma. And every time I speak to Erik, and I still speak to Erik today, he says to me, he wants to come back.
And mine happened, May the 2nd, 1998, Royal Albert Hall. Sergei Devikov, a fight, a routine defence that I was going into. And it was, like I say, a routine one. I'd beaten people that had beaten him before. And you think, and I had tragic things going on in my life, like sort of 2 weeks before. And thought, no, it's fine. I'm going to go in there. Like, you know, I'm just going to get this job done. Do you know what I mean? Like, things were going on in my life that, you know, that I was like, should I pull out? Should I not pull out? Personal issues that were going on. I won't go into, but it was personal issues going on, not health reasons at all, but just personal issues, like family life going on, and I thought, I need to pull out of this fight, and I didn't pull out of it, and what happened, and you go, like, but that's not the reason why that sort of happened. I just had to go through with what I was doing. But, you know, like, May the 2nd, like I say, 1998, travelling to the Royal Albert Hall, wake up 12 days later, still thinking I'm at the Royal Albert Hall. The only difference now is I've got, like, a 98 staples in my head to where they had to literally remove half my head, stop a bleed on the right side of my brain, pull it back, staple my skull back together. And I wake up looking around thinking, I must have been knocked out. Wow. And I go, like, I'm still thinking it's May the 2nd. And I'm looking and I'm thinking, why's my mum there? Why's my dad there? And, you know, my partner and all these important people in my life. So I've got a ventilator in my mouth and the doctor's saying to me, do you know who this is? And I'm nodding, well, this is my mum. Do you know, this is my dad. And I'm thinking, what's going on? And they're putting ballpoint pens in my hands to see, because 2 or 3 days after I had the operation, my eyes were stayed dilated as well. And they were signing, torturing my eyes. And they said to my mum, look, I think at best he's going to be paralysed down his left side and he's going to be blind, because I was not reacting to what, like, the, you know, what he was meant to be acting. Your pupils were meant to be moving, etc. So we went through that. So I'm asking what that is. So 3 or 4 days after that, I've got to learn to walk again. I've got up and I'm thinking, wow, at this stage, I'm still thinking I'm going to box again. At this stage, I thought, bloody hell, I must have been knocked out quite bad here. I'm going to be out for a year or so.
Right.
And I've got up and they said, look, Spencer, you know, they took the catheter out and whatnot. I said, look, we're going to start walking today. I'm looking, I'm going, is there a problem? And I go, no, there's no problem. There's no problem. I'm still thinking I'm like a day after the fight or something. Get up on a Zimmer frame. It's the most insane thing. I get up on a Zimmer frame. And I think, why are my legs not working? I go, because I remember jogging to the ring. And now I'm trying to move my legs. And, like, you know, I had to go through this rebuilding process, which was the most insane thing you could ever imagine, going from a kid that had the world at his feet to losing everything and having to rebuild your life, having to learn to walk again, talk again, and just go through the simple things in life. And it was just such an insane thing. But when I look back on it now, and if you ask me a question, you go, like, would you do it again? I go, I would do it every day of the week and twice on Sunday. Even though I'd been through that experience, go, if I could, like, there's not a day that goes past when I think, oh, I wish I could just do that again. Go in there. I know that may sound completely insane because of, you know, what I'd been through, but that's just the mentality, I think, of the fighter. That, and that's what's, you know, so I can relate to a lot of what Mike was going through and the reasons why he kept that personal and why he kept that to himself, because I knew what he was trying to achieve. And he recognises having seizures and whatnot. He go, they'll take my licence off me. I won't be able to do this. I totally get it. As insane as it sounds, I understand it. I relate to it.
What about the people around you at the time, Spenny? Because there's another story in the book, Pete, where you talk about the brother of a boxer who's at the fight and he's just so upset, visibly upset, watching his brother get punched. So the people around you, surely, you've got that love for boxing. You'd do it all again. They wouldn't, would they?
Absolutely. That's a great question, because my dad at the time took a team of boxers. Anthony Joshua was included, I think. It was before Anthony Joshua, actually. But he used to take a team of boxers. Joshua did box over there to Las Vegas for London against Las Vegas. And it was the first time my dad had never been at a fight, amateur or pro. So he was over in Vegas. And this was before we had social media then, I think, in 1998. So he didn't know. So he got a phone call saying, look, your son's collapsed and he's into a coma and we don't know if he's going to live or die. So he had to get on a plane not knowing whether I was still alive or what, and he'd come over, and it was like, you know, so from my dad's point of view, and my mum, who had never ever been at a fight, amateur or pro, got the phone call as well, and they're there, and I've come around and they say, listen, look, Spence, you've got to recognise, like, you know, how lucky you are. You've been given a second opportunity, and you look at how Michael Watson, and that changed medical science, you know, with getting the anaesthetist at ringside and all that sort of stuff, you know, and I think that was effectively what saved me, you know, with Michael Watson and what he had been through just in 1990, which was like 8 years before 1991 or whenever it was. That sort of changed the pathways and, you know, got the right medical procedures at ringside and whatnot. And I just look at it, and my dad would say, and my mum would say, look, you're so lucky. But inside I was going, you don't recognise, I'm the most unlucky person in the world because I can't do what I need to do and what I wanted to do. And it was just, these mixed emotions are insane, because you should be going, I celebrate life now, because it was 25, 26 years ago, it was in 1998, 26 years ago. So now I've gone from every day on May the 2nd, I used to sit there crying in the dark room going, like, why me? How unlucky am I? You know, why me? And then you listen to the stories of like Mike Tell, who didn't make it and he didn't come through. And now I sort of celebrate going, I've had 26 bonus years, as opposed to the way I used to think when it was like that. And like all the people around me going, Spencer, like, you count yourself lucky. And I used to think, what are they talking about? Count myself lucky. Now I understand it. Do you know what I mean? As the years have gone on and I've had time to process it and understand it, like my mum and dad going, what are you going on about, you ungrateful little... You know what I mean? Like, you know, you've been given a second bite of the cherry. Not many people get that. You know, poor Mike Tower never got that opportunity. Yeah. So now I sort of sit back and on May the 2nd, I go out there and I celebrate life as opposed to what it used to be. But it's weird how the mind changes over the years and when you start to recognise really what it is and how fortunate I was coming through, you know, that when you see people like that and Gerald McLennan, whose life has been severely, you know, messed up as well through that fight with Nigel Benn. You just look at them people and I just think, Spence, you're really lucky.
Yeah. But you'd still miss it, though. But you miss the sensation of fighting, or...
Do you know what I miss the sensation of? And this is going to sound insane. I miss the sensation, of course, of getting punched in the face. And that, like, how weird is that? I miss the things, like waking up in the morning and your face feeling really bruised. Or I miss, weirdly, like after the fight, if you picked up a cut in a fight, so you didn't get taken straight to hospital because they couldn't put the adrenaline in you because it was too dangerous because your body had been pumping so much around. So you get taken to the dressing rooms, and they would stitch you up. Get this. They'd stitch you up. They'd lie you on a bench or whatever it was. The doctor would come in and he'd stitch you up. You feel a needle going in, popping the skin, blending it. So, like, they're stitching you up. That was more painful than a fight, by the way, because you've got no anaesthetic there at all. And it's weird things like that that I miss.
You miss that?
because it's not there. I know, it's insane, isn't it?
The punch in the face thing. So we'll have a go if you want, if you're missing it that much.
Yeah. So now you're thinking, what, have they left a spanner in there or something? Something's not worked there. But it's the weird things that you know that will never happen again. And so in a weird way, you do miss it. But if I could relive it and they said to me, Spence, you would be okay to go in there and there would be no, you know, dangers through what you'd been through, then I'd do it every day of the week.
Do you know what I miss? That I call it the split second. So when you're in the ring, like, okay, I never boxed, you know, in great level, but when you're in the ring and you see an opening and you can put your hand in there and you have that split second, missed that feeling of being 25 and knowing that you can do that.
Do you know what I thought he was going to say?
Go on.
That split second when you get cracked and you've got, and you've lost that split second, and then you come back again. I thought that's where you was going then.
No, I missed that. I missed when you see the opening and you can know, because I'm southpaw, right? So I know that my left hand comes in, and then when that split second, and you know I can get a hand in, I missed that.
Yeah.
Or I missed the point where when I used to get sparred, I used to put me in with some monsters because I think every boxing gym hated me because people used to put me in with the monsters, right? And you get with a big monster and they hit you and it doesn't really hurt that much and you can smile and go, oh, I enjoyed that. I missed those things.
See what I mean, Pete? Like, we're talking here now and you go, like, when you start reliving this stuff and that, you go, there's certain things of boxing that you actually miss. But, you know, reading at the beginning of the book there, when you get to that certain age, like 35, when you know your brain knows what you want it to do, but you can't get out of the way anymore and you're getting hit with shots. And actually, it's now starting to hurt because it's a young man's sport. It's not an old man's sport. And you get to that age where your feet are not quite as fast, a bit like a footballer that gets a little bit off the pace. You know, he's never going to play Premiership anymore. He's going to drop through the leagues. And boxing's very much like that because the mind tells you you're still very much there because the mind doesn't get old, but the body does. And I think that it's there. And the day that you recognise, again, at the beginning of the book, the day you recognise that my time's done here in the boxing ring, you know, now you're starting to become afraid of what you're going into and whatnot, as opposed to enjoying it. But once it's gone, and you yourself, you just said it, you go, once it's gone, there's certain elements of that you miss.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also miss being in the gym as well. I miss being around the guys in the gym because it was a good, healthy, masculine environment. But yeah, like, if I could go back now to being 25 and fighting like I used to fight, man, I'd do it in a heartbeat.
There you go.
Well, there's a great quote in the book from the female boxer Zoe Hunt Smith, who says boxing is a drug that never leaves you, and I think we've just all witnessed and heard the evidence of that. It's the William Hill Sports Book Club. This is Talk Sport 2.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like, what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome. Like, what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I was going to rip his heart out. I'm the best ever. I'm the most brutal and vicious and most ruthless champion there's ever been.
Uppercut, and Marvis is hurt.
Frazier is down. Joe Cortez moves in to have a look. And he's going to stop the fight. It did not last 20 seconds. Tyson goes over to take a look at Marvis Frazier, obviously quite concerned.
There's no one can stop me. Lynx is a conqueror. No, I'm Alexander. He's no Alexander. I'm the best ever.
Now there's blood coming from the mouth of Pickle Thomas. Big left hook. Thomas looks like he's ready to go. He's going to hang on. Nail with the right hand. Thomas is in a heap of trouble. He's getting nailed by Tyson. This could be it. Thomas really nailed. Big left hook, big right hand. Down it goes, Pickle Thomas.
There's never been anybody as ruthless. I'm Sonny Liston, I'm Jack Dempsey, there's no one like me, I'm from Nairclough, there's no one that can match me.
Right hand hurt Larry again, he's back to the body, goes to draw right hand, just flipped with a big right hand, he won't get up from this one, it's all over. Joe Cortez has seen enough, and Larry Holmes is knocked.
rock star. My style is impetuous. My defense is impregnable. And I'm just ferocious. I want your heart. I want to eat his children.
And that is the first time Michael Spinks has ever been down in a professional fight.
And he's down again and in serious trouble. A right hand right on the chin. No love, I do them all like that.
Mike Tyson, we all remember how scary he was at his peak. And in the book, Death of a Boxer by Pete Carville, he says he had been awesome, considered the greatest and most destructive fighter of his or any age. His fights were all fireworks and noise, knockouts and knockdowns. Brilliant writing again. And then you talk about the end of his career. And let's go back even further. A fighter that Pete Carville describes as the all-time best of the best, Sugar Ray Robinson. The end of his career was certainly not covered in glory.
Forget your Cessna trumpet fanfares. It's the skirl of the pipes at Paisley Ice Rink. A tribute that only Scotland can pay to one of the greatest ever in the fight game, incomparable Sugar Ray Robinson, matched against Mick Leahy. The promoter, Peter Keenan. And a big reception for Sugar Ray, the man who was five times middleweight champion of the world. But tonight, he has two opponents, British title holder Leahy and Age. Robinson can't wear Leahy down. The old champ no longer packs a lethal punch. And as they come up for the tenth round, the only question is, which man will get the verdict on points? All over, and referee Ike Powell gives Leahy the verdict, surely by the narrowest of margins. Congratulations to Mick Leahy. To his opponent, it seems a sad farewell. In this game, there's no room at the top for the over 40s, not even for Sugar Ray Robinson.
Yeah, pretty sad end. And it didn't actually end there with a defeat in Paisley for Sugar Ray Robinson. He had another 20 fights after that, winning 13 of them. And I think Pete Carville, this, what you describe in the book about how some of the great fighters like Sugar Ray, like Mike Tyson, go on to have exhibition fights or they're visiting attractions, which, I mean, that's a real sadness. But it's also more evidence of the drug that is boxing that they can't get out of their system.
It is, but it's also evidence of like bad financial management. If you take a young kid who's 22, right, probably doesn't know much about financial planning, probably comes from a poor background, you know, and you suddenly start giving them these huge paydays, but then you lose one or two and the huge paydays stop and then you have to find something else to do. So I give you an example of this. Many years ago, Antonio Tarver and Glenn Johnson fought. I think it was the first fight, and Antonio Tarver wins. His next fight, he goes on, he gets $1.5 million to fight Roy Jones. Glenn Johnson, in his next fight, after coming off the split decision loss of Fight of the Year, makes $15,000. That's how big the split is when you, between winning and losing. So a lot of these guys, when they start becoming the visiting attraction, as it were, and the example I use most in the book here is Roy Jones Jr., is because they've got financial problems and they know if they go to, you know, if they go to Germany or, you know, Russia or any of these thingy out the way places, they can make more money because people are going to turn up so they can say, hey, I watched Roy Jones fight live. You know, that's something they can tell the grandkids. But when it comes to Mike Tyson and Roy Jones, like, I mean, and Spencer may be with me on this, is that if they were doing an exhibition next week in London, you would still go just so you could say that you'd seen Mike Tyson fight.
Absolutely. Live. Listen, when they had that exhibition, actually, Mike Tyson and Roy Jones Jr., I knew what it was, and we covered it here on TalkSport, actually. Mm. But for me, it was about reliving that Mike Tyson ring walk, seeing him clicking his neck, coming in, little black shorts, black boots and whatnot. That's where the enjoyment for me stopped. When the first bell rang, it was like watching two old men going at it, and you go, actually, it's quite a sad spectacle because, as you highlighted there, Pete, you know, that these guys earn phenomenal money, and it's bad management and maybe being too young and, you know, blowing the money wherever, and then when the time comes for them to, you know, get that financial security, the age has left them because it's a young man's sport and it's gone, and they try and continue, and so it is a little bit of a mixture of, yeah, the guy, like, it's difficult, it is a drug and it's difficult to give up, but the only reason they continue fighting when they know the fight has left them is because of the financial security. So that's just really bad management and people that are around them, you know, like Mike Tyson. You think the money that Mike Tyson earned, and you know how he ended up bankrupt. I think when he boxed Lennox Lewis, he boxed that fight and he was getting $20 million, $30 million or whatever, and that was all for the tax man because of the bad, you know, because of the bad management he'd had with Don King and all the people that were surrounding him. So, like, that's the sad side of the sport and people that don't see. And, like, a lot of these fighters that do go on too long, like, you see them, you think, you know, you've earned phenomenal money, but unfortunately not looked after it. And that's why you're continuing, as opposed to the drug for the sport and the love for the sport. They're doing it for the financial reasons as opposed to the other.
Yeah, this also, I think, is also one of the most boxing stories in the book, is that when it came to the Mike Tyson, Roy Jones exhibition, I think Mike is actually doing okay now. Like, he had horrendous debt at one point. I think he's doing all right. But Mike did it, apparently, to give Roy a payday. Because Roy Jones, against anybody else, is not the same amount of money as him doing the exhibition against Mike Tyson. Mike Tyson did it to put some money in Roy's pocket, which is, I think, is a boxing thing. I think that's something that a fighter would do for another fighter.
Do you know what I think is very sad, though? Like you think now, and I'm praying it doesn't happen like this, and I'm praying that it comes out and we do see Mike Tyson, and I'm hoping it's an exhibition, actually, Mike Tyson versus Jake Paul, and you go, right, for me growing up, what inspired me as a young kid growing up, getting up at night in 1986, listening to the radio, Mike Tyson knocking out Trevor Burbick. And when you listen to the radio, like, it's sort of like, you know what I mean? You sort of, you felt like you was there, you visualised it, because that's sort of, it drew you in. And my dad getting me up and listening to that, and he was a phenomenon, wasn't he, doing all that. And now you go, right, he's going in with Jake Paul. Please don't knock him out. Like, please don't let that be a memory that you've got. He's seeing an old Mike Tyson, an old worn Mike Tyson go in there and Jake Paul, you know, knocks him out. I'm hoping that that is more an exhibition as opposed to a real fight, because I think that's not really understood yet. But you go, like you say, Pete, yeah, he's earned a lot of money. He's earning a lot of money now. You know, he's got, you know, he's got various businesses outside of boxing where he's earning a lot of money, personal appearances and whatnot. So why would you come back? Yeah, I recognise there'd be 20, 30 million pound on the table, but you go, you're talking about legacies here. This guy's an icon. You know, you're talking about the people like Muhammad Ali, like Mike Tyson will be remembered for generations to come. Why would you come back against Jake Paul if it wasn't for financial reasons and only financial reasons? Because it don't make sense.
No, it doesn't. I mean, I would say Mike Tyson's what? How old are you? 56, 57?
58, I think.
58, is he now? Like, I still, even, I wouldn't fight him at 58.
Nobody would do that to yourself.
Do you know what the concern is? And I think that, you know, a lot of people that see it, they go, you watch now, we've got social media, haven't we? And social media plays a big part in everything now, you know, selling fights and whatnot. And people are watching 15-second clips of Mike Tyson whacking the pads, and you're going, he looks phenomenal. But let me tell you, three-minute rounds are totally different, right? And you've got a young, and it is a young man's sport.
Yeah.
Jake Paul is like, he's building a good little career for himself. He's improving all the time. He's fell in love with the, you know, he's fell in love with the art of boxing. And you go, Mike Tyson, you go, yeah, you look phenomenal. But what happens when that minute's gone? And you start hitting the brick wall, and then, like, that strength starts leaving you. Because I can tell you, when you get tired in a boxing ring and the strength leaves you, your strength goes from being like this, like I say, the Hercules type character to a little child. And that's the reality of it. And it happens very, very quickly as well. I just hope that it is an exhibition for those reasons, and Mike, you know, gets a few quid out of it. But we just don't, it's not a spectacle where you watch it and go, wow, you're watching this fight as a, a shadow of his former self.
But is he doing it for the money? Is he just doing it? Is Mike Tyson believe that I'm trying to prove a point here? That I'm boxing through and through, and I'm not having someone from the social world come into my sport and make a mockery of it. I'm going to prove once and for all that boxers are boxers.
Well, listen, I think that we have to rewind when you go, what was it, 20, 25 years ago when he had his last fight against Kevin McBride? And what a sad spectacle that was. We saw this guy that was like, you know, we listened to those clips there earlier, and you get your, you know, adrenaline going and your hair's standing up on the back of your neck. And I relived those moments of Mike Tyson, like Tyson Mania, what it was like back then, to the end of his career, his last professional fight that he had, like I say, 20, 25 years ago against Kevin McBride. And you go, this guy was a shell of his former self. And like, you go in there and you just looked at that and you go, 20 years on, the life that Mike's lived, you know what I mean? Like, the life that that guy has lived outside of boxing, you just go, is he going to be the like anything near his former self? I don't know.
It's a tough one, but you're right. I think we should, I don't think we'll ever forget the impact Mike Tyson had when we were younger.
Absolutely.
You and I are of a similar age, and you might be a little bit younger than me. You get
49. How old are you?
Just a bit, yeah, just a little bit older. But I remember listening to the radio. Boxing on the radio, it's weird. I'm radio biased, but I think it's better than boxing on telly because you can picture it all. And those big nights for Tyson were sensational. And he was, for me, still the ultimate.
I agree. I agree. You will never get better. I don't think there will never be another Mike Tyson in our lifetimes. Like you say, how he transformed the sport. This young kid of 20, like I say, got boxing for the world heavyweight title. And at that time, you know, we weren't seeing the fights and the build-up and the hype. And you go, like, all of a sudden, we started hearing about this phenomenon, this monster, this young guy that was over. He's going to take over the world. He's going to be the next big thing in boxing. And he was so charismatic outside the ring as well that he was the complete package. You know, you look at that. You go, there's not many people that could do that. Like, you look at Muhammad Ali, who was, you know, as big outside of the ring and what he stood for and the way that he changed, you know, the way that he changed everything. But he was brilliant inside the ring as well. Mike Tyson was sort of like, he's up there with that, where he was so charismatic outside of the ring. He brought something different to the sport. And, I think that's why we now go, I can't believe that I grew up as a kid listening to Mike Tyson. Well, it is a weird fact, a weird stat, actually. I grew up listening to Mike Tyson on the radio in 1986. I was an 11-year-old kid then. I had my first amateur fight when I was 11, on my 11th birthday, because you had to be 11 to box. So I'm just having my first amateur fight. Mike Tyson is boxing for the world heavyweight title. Mike Tyson is still boxing now, and I've been retired 26 years. Work that out.
Wow.
Work that out.
He's not really boxing now, is he?
Well, he's putting the gloves on. Okay. He's
getting up there, isn't he? Yeah. What I find interesting, Spencer, you come in on this, is that the fighters that we watch when we're young compare always favourably to the fighters we watch now.
Yeah.
So when I was getting into it years ago, like the top guy was Joe Calzaghe. I was there the night he beat up Jeff Lacey in Manchester, right? So it was like Calzaghe and it was Pacquiao. And
yeah.
Maybe not Mayweather. I don't like Mayweather that much. But those guys, whenever I look at them now, they always compare favourably to the guys today. But I reckon if you go back to 2001, 2, 3, 4, 5, when I was watching these guys, anyone who had been in the game for 20 years at that point would say, nah, it was Mike Tyson.
Yeah. It's an interesting one, because we've got a debate going on today about different eras and whatnot, and because of what's going on in the heavyweights right now and the landscape of the heavyweights right now, we're comparing Lennox Lewis to this era. Where would Lennox Lewis fit in this era of heavyweights? When you're talking about Tyson Fury, Anthony Joshua, Deontay Wilder, Zhele Zhang, all those guys, you go, where would Lennox fare right now?
Lewis is the number one, surely.
I'm with you.
Yeah, I'm with you.
So, you know, when you're doing comparisons and comparing fighters, you just look at it and you go, anybody that's not watched Lennox Lewis fights that may be listening to this, go back on YouTube, have a look at it, see just how good he was.
And he was huge.
Do you know what the problem was for Lennox Lewis? Lennox Lewis fell into that bracket of Larry Holmes, right, where Larry Holmes lived in the shadows of Muhammad Ali because we had a great.
Yeah.
Lennox Lewis doesn't get the recognition he deserves because he lives in the shadows of Muhammad Ali because he was that guy. And that's pretty much where we're at. You know, you look at Larry Holmes and look what a phenomenal fighter he was. He never got the recognition that he deserved because Muhammad Ali was before him. And I think that stands for Lennox Lewis as well with Mike Tyson. You know, if you look at that, you go, this guy's never really got the accolades that he should have.
No, I agree with that. And I think the reason, let me just qualify when I said he's huge. They're all huge.
Mm-hmm.
But I think people might listen to this and say, well, listen, Lennox Lewis, but what about Tyson Fury and his height? Lennox Lewis was way taller, I think, than people think. You know,
he's a big man.
By 6'6",
yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But he was like 17 stones. Lennox Lewis's size would fit in with the guys of today, without a doubt.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated. There's a piece on page 236 of the book, so towards the end of the book, where it talks about, you talk about the legacy in the sport, and you actually say there is no legacy in the sport. So you talk about, unlike sports teams, there's no legacy in the sport. The Boston Red Sox in 2023, same team as it was in 1973, even as time has shifted and changed its roster, and you go on and on. I'm intrigued as to what you mean by there's no legacy in the sport of boxing, because the fights in Saudi, for example, the YouTubers that we've talked about before coming in, MMA fighters coming into boxing, isn't that stuff all part of a new legacy for boxing?
No, when I say legacy in the sense of page 136, because I've just had to go back and read now because I completely forgot what it said. It's more that if you have a team like Everton, like my family are Evertonians, right? The team's always it's always the same team, right? The players change, right? But the team's always the same. In boxing, like you say, you have someone big. We were talking about Manny Pacquiao a couple of seconds ago. Manny Pacquiao's that 6, 7, 8 year run. He's the best fighter on the planet, right? Well, as soon as he retires, the Manny Pacquiao brand is gone, right? Whereas Everton, like, changes its roster, you know, every 5 or 6 years, it's always Everton. So this is what I mean by a legacy in the sport, Right? It's a hard one. You can't really have a long-term plan for boxing as a business because you go from fight to fight. It's where boxing differs from the UFC. So the UFC, they number their events, and it's you watch the brand in UFC, whereas boxing, you watch the fighters.
I think the heavyweight, the world heavyweight champion is not just the pinnacle of boxing, but is the pinnacle of sport. And I think that's where the legacy's at. The world heavyweight champion has always, you know, historically been remembered globally. Like, if you think you're going back, you know, like I said to you, Muhammad Ali and Mike Tyson, those guys, them guys were, you know, Mike Tyson at the time was probably more famous than the American president. What I'm saying is that I think legacy is in the...
in the title itself.
In the title itself, yeah. World heavyweight champion is pretty much known all over the world. And I think that that's where the legacy lies in boxing.
Yeah, the problem is that when you end up with three or four different heavyweight champions, then it gets, yeah, it gets one a little bit tricky.
One of them's the standout one, though, isn't it? Always. Heavyweight boxing, yeah. I mean, yeah. Look, right now you go like Anthony Joshua, Tyson Fury, Deontay Wilder, those guys. Mm. More so Anthony Joshua, I think, because of what he... and where his journey to, from where he went from to where he went to, and in millions of around the world that he inspired on that journey, where it's like that he touched outside of boxers because he went on to win the Olympic gold medal and then went on to, you know, win the World Heavyweight Championship. But where his journey was, you know, the, where it started and where it ended up, I think he inspired millions of kids around the world to go, listen, I can do that. If he can do it, I can do that. He was just a normal kid coming from a very poor background to transforming his life. And I think that that was, that that touched millions.
Spence, yeah. I don't disagree with that. But Pete, I sense in the book that you really are disillusioned with the heavyweight division right now.
No, I love the heavyweight division like that. I love watching it. If it's on, I'll watch it. Like, I love going to fights, right? But I'm disillusioned with the business side of it because the best fights don't get made. Like, if this was... possibly not the right way to put it. If this was a serious sport, like the Premier League or whatever, Tyson Fury and Anthony Joshua would have fought two or three times by now.
Yep.
They haven't fought once, right? The fact you've had Wilder versus Tyson Fury, they've fought three times. That's great, right? But we're still missing the Fury-Joshua fight. We're still missing Fury-Usyk. You've got the younger guys coming through like Dubois and Joe Joyce, right? They should have fought each other at least two or three times now. They've only fought... once.
Do you know what? Do you know what, though? That is all about to change, and we will see that over the next 12 months, that you will have all of those people that you just said fighting each other. And the reason that happens is because of the investment of the Saudi money. And the reason it hasn't happened in the past is because of the politics of the sport, as in with Tyson Fury saying being on TNT and Anthony Joshua on Sky Sports, and where is the purse split going to go? Is it going to be 60-40? Who's going to get the TV rights? What TV company is going to get it? That's the business side of it that you get disillusioned with. And I think now with the investment of Turki Al-Sheikh and the investment backing of those fights will be made because he's putting the money on the table. So we will see those fights. Like, we're
is that a
get...
promise you're making us?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Do you want me to tell you the roadmap? Do you want me to tell you the roadmap of this?
Go on.
So I'm going to give you the roadmap right now. So Anthony Joshua is going to be fighting at Wembley Stadium, right, so that people don't get disillusioned with all the big fights now going over to Saudi. Yeah. Anthony Joshua is fighting at Wembley Stadium. Philip Hergovich and Daniel Dubois are boxing on June the 1st. They're boxing June the 1st, and that will probably be for the vacant IBF title because we've got May the 18th, and Tyson Fury versus Alexander Usyk. There's a rematch clause in that, so Fury and Usyk will box again. Anthony Joshua will box the winner of Philip Hergovich and Daniel Dubois at Wembley Stadium, possibly for the vacant, possibly for the IBF title. Usyk and Fury will have those two fights. Anthony Joshua will then box the winner of that. Hopefully it's Tyson Fury, so we get that fight, Anthony Joshua versus Tyson Fury. In between that, Anthony Joshua has already said that, or Turki Al-Sheikh has already said, the winner of Daniel Dubois, Philip Hergovich, Zhele Zhang versus Deontay Wilder, the winner of each of those contests, whatever one looks better, is boxing Anthony Joshua after So we're getting all the fights together, if that made sense.
Yeah. There's two things there, though. One is that the Joshua Fury fights have 5-6 years past their best, right? It should have happened.
I don't know.
Maybe they should have happened 5-6 years ago, right? When they were both a little bit younger. That's one. Second is that it's Saudi Arabia. Like, that's not good money. That's dirty money. They imprison people for being gay. They cut apart a journalist with a bone saw. Like, by taking their money, it dirties a sport that's already dirty.
I'm not sure. Listen, I think that people that are not looking that far into it, people are going, people that are boxing fans go, I just want to see the fight. And they don't look through the layers of it and where it's going from. Because I think that you're going maybe a little bit too deep into it then. And you go, like, it's always going to be about that argument about the investment of Saudi Arabia or whatever. I think for the boxing fan, though, what I'm saying is that we're getting the fights that we've longed for years. So as a sports fan, you go, there you go, we're getting it.
I agree with you, Pete. It's highly debatable. I think it is. It's another debate.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm.
You've got the debate about when are we going to see these fights, and then the debate about where we're going to see these fights.
Yeah.
And I think that those two things can be kept separate. I just want to bring it back to the, to the book, which is excellent.
Can I just add?
Yeah.
I think there's going to be a balance. I think you'll see some fights in Saudi Arabia, but they're not going to forget about America, and they're not going to forget, like Wembley, because they know that they can't forget about that. So you will see fights over in Saudi Arabia, but I think you'll still fend. Also, Saudi Arabia have done something which has not been able to be done for a long time. They've got Matchroom and
Queensbury
talking and working together in partnership, which has not happened.
There's a love affair now, Frank Warren and Eddie Hearn, who, trust me, that dislike is probably a generous word with these two. There's no love with these two. Now they're like, you know what I mean? There is like a proper love affair going on there. And the only reason that is because of the investment, again, of Saudi Arabia, bringing these two promoters together so that we can get the best fighting the best. And that's pretty much where we're at. But there's always going to be a debate, isn't there, when, you know, surrounding it. And I totally understand that.
But back to the book.
Sure.
Neil Foggin, first of all, just to finish off, it is an excellently written book. I've not really touched on some of the beautiful writing that's in it, and sometimes I don't want to quote too much from the book so that people can read it for themselves and see how beautifully written it is. But I think when you've got a book called Death of a Boxer, Neil, and there's some really harrowing subjects in there, to be so beautifully written, I think is worth a mention.
It's crafted, and we always say when we're discussing books in our book club, when we're discussing them for the long list, you want people who put the hard work in. And this has got lots of interviews. The research has been done. It's crafted. The words, it's like radio, like what we said, it's better than watching it on TV. Mm. And you always say, the book's always better than the film. This just, everything comes to life with it. There's one thing I want to ask is, and Spencer, to get your view on this, is when they're talking about the medical beforehand and the doctor says, have you had headaches? Mm-hmm. And he goes, no.
Yeah.
Is that what happens? Or does the doctor go, okay, that's it, nothing else? Yeah, surely that's not...
Well, the doctor won't know that unless they're having the brain scans, and he's obviously passed his brain scans before that, because you have to have them yearly. That is a fact. You have your CT scans and your MRI scans yearly every year. So the doctor's asking him that, and that's what we were touched upon, you know, in there with what Mike Towle was trying to achieve behind closed doors when he was, like, you know, keeping this dark secret to himself. And he asked the doctor, and his initial response was, if I say, yeah, I've had headaches, I know I'm not fighting. I know I'm not putting food on the table for my families, and that's taking away, you know, the only thing that I know how to earn money. So, you know, it's a really sad story, and that's the sad side of the sport. And
does it still go on?
Well, that was 6 years ago.
Yeah,
so
they've changed the regulations now. So the regulations had been that you essentially self-declared what was going on.
Yeah.
After what happened with Mike Towle, they brought in new regulations, which the boxers now, I think, have to sign a form that the board can contact the boxer's GP and get that information. How that works in practice, I don't know, because there's, like, you know, maybe a couple of thousand professional boxers in the UK right now, so I don't know how they're keeping track of this at the board. But that did change.
Right.
But even with that change, I'm not sure whether this could happen again.
Pete, thanks for coming in. Really
Thank
enjoyed
you for
the
having
book.
Me.
Congratulations again, and good luck with it as well.
Thank you so much.
Champ, great to speak to you as
always. Yeah, as always. And yeah, congratulations, Pete. By the way, I think the title of the book, Death of a Boxer, is genius, because straight away it draws you in. What is this? What is it all about? And when you see it, it is beautifully written, and I think you've done a fantastic job there. Well done.
Thank you so much.
It's brilliant. Just want to close by saying the inquiry into the death of boxer Mike Towle concluded this. Boxing was the centre of Mike Towle's life, which is always worth remembering when you're reading the story of what went on. Death of a Boxer by Pete Carville, one of the most thought-provoking sports books I've read in recent years. Till next time on the William Hill Sports Book Club, thanks for listening. A message to publishers: if you want to win the award, get your book in soon.
Hi,
This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.